The next case is 09820, Richard Jakes versus Patricia A. Manton. Mr. Dills.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Alan Dills, and I of the firm of Marshall and Melhorn in Toledo, Ohio, and I have the privilege of representing the appellant, the original defendant, Patricia Manton, in this matter. I would like to reserve 1 minute for a potential rebuttal, please. This is a case involving specifically this court's previous ruling in Robinson versus Bates, which this court issued in 2006. It involves the evidentiary issue of what evidence is permitted to be submitted to the jury on the question of reasonableness of the medical expenses incurred by a plaintiff in a case. The facts are relative, and in light of whether or not this court's decision in 2006 in Robinson versus Bates is still good law in light of the subsequent enactment. Well, actually, the legislature enacted 2315.20 during the time period that the case was proceeding to final opinion in December of 06.
Well, counsel, Robinson versus Bates didn't interpret that statute at all, did it?
Oh, I believe it did. In the body of the opinion, you discussed in a footnote, you referenced the fact that the statute had been enacted.
Right.
But you also, I believe, took the legislative history not only of the changes in the collateral source rules, but you also analyzed how it would come to be that your ruling would be interpreted under the new statute.
So we prospectively decided an issue that wasn't even in front of the court at that time.
You noted that it wasn't there, but our position in this case is that the decision that you reached, well-reasoned as it was in terms of fairness and balanced approach, it still coexists and does coexist and is still good law under the provisions of
2315. Well, why don't you start with the new statute and tell us what that says and what that means?
The new statute is a further narrowing of the collateral source rule that was adopted back in
75. And what does the statute say?
And the statute says that whereas before the defendant or whoever, wrongdoer, could not introduce into evidence any source of collateral benefits.
Well, I don't think the statute says that, does it?
Oh, no, the new one. I said before 2315.
Okay, but what does the new statute say?
The new statute says now the defendant can introduce, in subsection A, can introduce evidence of collateral benefits so long as there's not a right of subrogation attached to those benefits paid.
Okay, and okay. If there is?
If there is, then that evidence is not admissible.
Period. That's what the statute says.
Essentially, that's what the statute says.
Okay.
And our point in this case, and what the trial court and the Court of Appeals did in this case, was to, the facts are simple. There was $21,000 approximately in medical expenses charged. There was $7,000 and some odd paid. To the extent that that $7,000 was paid, Medical Mutual, the insurer, I believe it was, had a right of subrogation to that amount paid. But when you apply that reasoning then to Robinson versus Bates, wherein this court clearly held that the amount that is not paid is not a benefit, and it is not subject to the collateral source rule. So what you said in your opinion in 2006 in Robinson still holds good today and is compatible with the provisions of 2315.20.
So what would go on at the trial under your theory of how this should be handled under the new statute?
Since there is no right, since by statute.
Just tell me what evidence, what's the jury going to see? I think that's the critical
question.
They're
going to see exactly what this court recommended to be seen in Robinson versus Bates, and that is the gross number as well as the fact that the medical provider accepted an amount less than that in terms of its right of subrogation.
So they're going to see the presence of insurance when the statute says they wouldn't see the presence of insurance.
Oh, but I would respectfully disagree. If you read 2315.20 subsection A, if there's no right of subrogation, there's going to be insurance all over the record.
I understand, but you're talking about a case in which there was a right of subrogation.
Well, you could conceivably.
And the statute would mean that the jury would not be told about the insurance benefit.
But by statute, the only portion that anyone has a right of subrogation for is what was paid. By statute, no, you cannot subrogate against the person for anything greater than you have in fact paid. There is no right of subrogation then to that difference. So since there's no right of subrogation to that difference, that amount is completely admissible under 2315 because there cannot be any right of subrogation attached to it.
Mr. Dills, the Robinson case was really relating to the reasonableness of the expenses of the medical services and so on. And we did discuss write-off as you talked about. We also suggested in paragraph 19 that perhaps the collateral rule is out of sync, but that's for the General Assembly to deal with. One of the things that Robinson did not talk about or raise with this court was the problem that Justice Pfeiffer's talking about, the injection of insurance. And my concern, after reading the briefs here, is the practical implications for the trial judges who are attempting to sort out what Robinson means in their cases, each case one at a time, when on the one hand they're to not tell the jury anything, insurance is not to be a part of the case, and yet on the other, we have told them that they can consider both the original and the paid bill as evidence for them to consider.
This is true that the issue still is the reasonableness of the medical expense, and to give the jury the balanced approach to of all of the information to with which to balance it. And I understand your question to be, how does it actually work to avoid the injection by simply making the subtraction? But that occurs no matter what. If you read 2315, and I am permitted as the defendant to submit to the jury the fact that a non-subrogated insurer paid $10,000 of the $20,000 in bills, insurance is in the case.
You're saying that the new statute puts insurance in the case regardless.
It permits us. It is a narrowing of the previous collateral source rule. Under the previous collateral source rule, I, as a defendant in the trials, could not submit to the jury in any sense any payments received by the plaintiff. The defendant cannot take advantage of that benefit. That's why we had the collateral source rule. That's why it came into force in the first place. Then what the statute is, and if you examine the history of the statutes that have narrowed the collateral source rule over the years, some have been ruled unconstitutional, but nonetheless, the General Assembly has slowly narrowed that. And now what the new statute is a further narrowing of that, permitting now, for the first time, defendants to insert into the case the evidence that the plaintiff did receive collateral benefits. And in doing that, we inject insurance into the case. The General Assembly has said, by permitting us to do that, I can now say that through Blue Cross Blue Shield or whatever who perhaps has a contract, although that's rare to say these days, but nonetheless, it is conceivable that there would be a source of funds that does not have a right of subrogation that we would be permitted to place before the jury, and the only way that you do that is did you not receive payment in this amount of money from an insurance company.
Counsel.
That automatically, that portion of the statute, in essence, says that we're going to have to put that,
counsel,
if it operates at all.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. To use a phrase that was used here, how does that operate at trial? Except for this dispute about what you do with the write-off, the parties normally stipulate as to what the medical bills expenses were?
I think the artful use of requests for admissions through the discovery process can reduce it, because we're not really introducing the fact of payment or the source. In other words, the source of payment, because that's not permissible. We're simply introducing the fact. So through the use of interrogatories, requests for production of documents, the submission of restatement of payments by the insurers, however that evidence is marshaled, can be done well ahead of time. And in fact, we've been embroiled over the years now in many instances of massive disputes and motions to compel, because since the introduction of the new statute, we've been involved with resistance by the plaintiff's bar to even allow us to discover the Robinson versus Bates numbers. We're going through painful discovery proceedings, but that's the way to do it, and we simply present to the jury the fact that this is the number that was billed, and that the provider, not that somebody paid it, we're not identifying that, we're simply saying that the provider agreed to accept less as a measure of the reasonable value of the services. And as this court found in Robinson.
Counsel, why would you want to even, or what's the necessity of even acquiescing to the larger amount being introduced or put before the jury? If you've agreed through the pretrial discovery that $7,000 was paid for medical, it was accepted by the provider of the services, what's the point of exploring what was actually billed?
I think that satisfies the concern that Madam Justice Stratton had in the original Robinson case, and that was that you don't take away, in other words, what was billed and what was actually paid are not really definitive necessarily as to what the reasonable value of the services was. It is somewhere, just giving this information to the jury doesn't mean they have to accept one or the other. That then allows, for instance, the plaintiffs, who will make the argument and have in their briefs, that the higher number, if you take that away from them, they cannot argue that the higher number indicates a more serious injury because it required greater expense in its care and treatment. And the lower number would tend to lessen the value of their overall case in chief. So by adopting the balanced approach that was discussed very clearly in Robinson versus Bates, we give to the plaintiff the ability to still argue that portion of it, while we give to the jury both all information with which to make the decision on reasonableness.
Counsel,
Mr. Dills, is this,
yes,
being done by stipulation, or is this a subject of consternation in trial courts?
Well, until this case came along, many courts would permit us to do it, and many sides would permit us, and plaintiff's counsel would permit us to do it by stipulation. And in fact, that was the situation in Robinson versus Bates. In this particular case, there was a determination that there was less paid, but the judge would not permit us to proceed. Simply citing that since the facts of the case arose after the enactment of 2315.20, that Robinson no longer applied to the case at all. And that's why we're here seeking reversal of that decision, and the Sixth District Court of Appeals rubber stamped that decision.
Well, in your world, then, what would you want the law to be as it squares Robinson and this statute? What should we write that would clarify this from your vantage point?
I propose on behalf of the appellant that this court restate the balanced approach that was espoused in the original Robinson versus Bates, that this difference is not a benefit subject to the collateral source rule of 2315.20, and that the propositions of law that I have proposed to this court, I think, in essence, does that. Since the enactment of 2315, and it, I think it arose in the steaming cauldron of legal thinking in Northwest Ohio, was that by virtue of enactment of that statute, they could completely ignore this court's holding in Robinson versus Bates. And I believe that the propositions of law that we have presented to the court clearly restate this court's position in that and make it compatible with, because it's not a benefit. It's not a benefit for which a right of subrogation exists under 2315.
And you're saying that it's not an improper injection of insurance into the case? That's the question that I really
have.
That's
true. That's exactly what I'm saying. And I think I need to just quickly address, as part of the response on behalf of Appellee, they indicated that if this evidence were injected into the case and someone with a right of subrogation, if it comes into the case that there is insurance for this subrogated amount, that they would lose their rights of subrogation by reference to subsection C of the 2315. But if you read, and as we must give plain meaning to the words of the statute, if you read subsection C, what you see is that it is really a preventative subsection. It does not take away a right of subrogated interests. It actually prevents the creation of a subrogated interest to the evidence that is permitted by subsection A. In other words, we're allowed to put into evidence payments received by the plaintiff which don't have a right of subrogation. Subsection C simply says, and if you do under A, nobody gets a right of subrogation to those amount of payments.
On that point, you cited 1751.60 to us as, I think, also for the proposition that there's no right of subrogation here. I didn't see a response from the appellees on this point, but can you state what's the import of that section in your mind?
In terms of subrogation, we fully support the protection of subrogated interests, but the idea is meshing these two decisions, Robinson and the new statute, to the extent that it preserves the right of subrogation, that should be, but I'm not certain. What the remainder of your question is, Mr.
Well,
Chief Justice.
I hate to take the time to read it, but you cited it, and one of the amicus cited it also as, you know, it's accepted, provided, so forth. Every provider of health care facility that contracts with a health insurance corporation, the insurance company, to provide health care services to the health insuring corporation's enrollees or subscribers shall seek compensation for coverage services solely from the health insuring corporation.
Yes.
From the insurance company, and not under any circumstances from the enrollees, the person here who gets the coverage, or a subscriber except for approved co-payments or deductibles. That would seem to apply here.
Certainly does apply. What that does is restrict the institution, the medical insurer.
Right.
That restricts them from seeking any balance that might be unpaid or any excess from the enrollee or the insured personally.
Right. That's,
okay.
That's
and the provider, the hospital, has entered into this agreement with the insurer, And they have agreed to accept what they say is reasonable and customary services under the contract. And so that provider, by law, by statute, can only collect what the insurer will pay for those services.
The provider can't go against
it. And can't turn around to its insured and ask for more payment. That's why I say, and that's why, and or that's how this court reached its decision in Robinson when it said that there is no subrogation. It isn't a benefit. There's no subrogation that can attach to it.
Counsel, we're so far in the weeds now that this prompts another question in my mind as to what this trial is going to look like under your perfect world. So now we tell the jury, the hospital said the bill was $18,000, reasonable value of their services. But due to a contract that they had with Anthem, they agreed to accept $9,000. But Anthem's contract with the injured plaintiff says we have deductibles, so the injured plaintiff has to pay $1,500 or 20% of the bill. So now we got to, do you have to drag the jury into that, or else they would simply come back with the number that the hospital agreed to accept of $9,000, thinking that the plaintiff had been fully compensated? Or is the plaintiff going to have to explain, oh, yes, but I have this deductible that means I still have to pay $2,000 of it? So now the trial is all about these contracts of health insurance instead of about what the defendant did to the plaintiff.
What we're introducing to the jurors so that they can make a fair determination of the reasonableness of the care provided.
And so the plaintiff can be made whole if they believe that the defendant.
Yes, and that's really what this is all about, is to prevent a windfall, to prevent that difference from being something that the jury is not informed of in any way, shape, or form, and is led to believe that the plaintiff is responsible
for. Well, we wouldn't want any fictions in the courtroom, so why don't we tell them that the defendant's attorney is being paid for by the insurance company, and the defendant has $100,000 worth of liability insurance.
Your Honor, that's a discussion for another day, which I'd like to sit down and discuss with you.
Your red light is on, so thank you. Hey, saved by the red light, Mr. Dills. Thank
you.
Yes,
thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Bell.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please this court, I'm Mike Bell from Gallen, Takas, Boies, Nalton, Schaefer in Toledo. I'm going to reserve some of my time for Mr. Flowers. Your Honors, I think the questions that you've presented hit on one of the main points here, and that is, at the trial court level, the issue in Robinson v. Bates, the holding, this sort of compromise between the total amount of the charges and what is accepted as payment in full, really is causing havoc at the trial court level. Contrary to appellant's assertion, insurance is not injected pursuant to the statute. In this case, what the statute says is that any amount payable as a benefit to the plaintiff is permissible under certain circumstances. Now, those circumstances don't apply in this case because there is a clear contractual right of subrogation to the health insurance payer for Mr. Jakes.
But isn't the point that this is not the amount payable? The write-off is not paid to anyone? I mean, isn't that the crux of what we said in Robinson and what your opposing counsel emphasizes?
Certainly, the Robinson court held that write-offs or contractual adjustments are not benefits pursuant to the common law collateral source rule. When you apply that language to the statute, however, it's clear that the admission of write-offs in a personal injury trial, which is what this statute speaks to, is per se evidence of the amount payable by a health insurance carrier or the collateral benefit provided. If that health insurance carrier has a right of subrogation, those amounts cannot be admitted in the trial court.
Under Robinson, though, why can't you, I mean, you lose me at that because you're assuming that you have to introduce insurance. Instead, you say the bill is $21,000, the hospital agreed to take $7,000 total. Now, that $7,000 includes what the hospital agreed to take, what the insurance company pays, and what your deductible is to get that full amount. But the jury doesn't have to know that. All the jury knows is the hospital bill is $21,000, you paid $7,000, that is the plaintiff's actual damages. And there's no need to say anything about insurance. You can speculate all you want, but even if you told the jury the hospital bill was $21,000, there was no write-off, the jury could still speculate that this person has some insurance to pay for it. What the jury is getting is the actual amount paid that they can evaluate against the total amount, which I still favored admitting because sometimes the total amount is a more accurate measure of the injury rather than all the reasons that result in a write-off. That's why we had this compromise in that you have the one extreme example of a couple million dollars and they took $500,000. It's really letting the jury say, okay, the hospital agreed to take less, but this is what the reasonable value was, and they could go the total amount, the lesser amount, somewhere in between.
You raise a couple of points, Your Honor. With regards to the $7,000 figure, as you put out there, part of that figure would include subrogated health insurance benefits. And therefore, under 2315.20, those are inadmissible. Be it a part of a cumulative number that you put to the jury, the statute says when there's a right of subrogation by a contractual third party, those numbers are inadmissible to a jury.
Tell me how the subrogation would work in this case where
Sorry,
the
Your Honor.
Tell me how the subrogation you're suggesting would work in this case where the company paid the provider X number of dollars and the provider said that's it, we're done. So the plaintiff doesn't get any more money. There's no right to recover from, apparently under the statute, to recover from, for the insurance company to recover what it paid from anyone. Where's the subrogation issue? How would that work here?
Sure. If in this case, for instance, the health insurance payor has a right to collect from the plaintiff post-judgment any amounts paid on his behalf for the bills, he has a right against to stand in the shoes of the plaintiff and pursue the amounts paid pursuant according to the injuries sustained by the plaintiff. In a case like this, what you have when that contractual right is asserted by the health insurance carrier, the plaintiff in a personal injury action, I'm sorry, the defendant in a personal injury action is not permitted to submit those amounts to the jury. It's the amounts of the collateral source that are inadmissible, but only when there's a right of contractual subrogation, Your Honor. Mr. Dills was right, 2315.20 did limit the common law collateral source rule.
C, subsection C?
No, subsection A limited the common law collateral source rule and allowed defendants to submit these amounts to a jury, except when there's this contractual right of subrogation pursuant to the plaintiff's health insurance policy.
But as I read A, you can say to the jury when there's no subrogation, the insurance paid this amount, and my client still is obligated for this amount. And when there is a contractual right of subrogation, you can't say to the jury, insurance paid this amount. But still, if you say $21,000 and you don't admit the amount that's actually paid and subrogated, then your client's going to get $11,000, $12,000 difference that he never is actually incurred as a damage.
2317.421, Your Honor, permits the plaintiff to introduce the total amount of charges incurred as a result of his or her injuries, with the right of the defendant to counter-argue that those charges are unreasonable under the circumstances. As a further protection, the judge has the option of remitter at the end of judgment if he or she believes that the amounts awarded by the jury were excessive or unreasonable under the circumstances.
Counsel, what would the argument be that the amounts were unreasonable? If you give the gross amount, even though insurance has paid, what would be the counter for the defendant to allege, or what evidence would be used to say that those are unreasonable charges?
What would the defendants present at trial to?
Yes.
Okay. I suppose they could call witnesses, Your Honor. They can call experts to testify as to what's reasonable in the locality They can introduce evidence of, if there's a certain charge that just, I don't have a good answer to that question.
Well, that's why I asked it. I don't have an answer to it either.
Well, let me
I'm
ask.
Trying to figure out if you're going to dispute it, the cost of a broken leg, and somebody says, well, this is what the hospital billed and the physician, and you're going to say, well, geez, Dr. Smith would have done it for half of that.
Well,
then you're going to bring Dr. Smith on and say, yeah, we fix broken legs for a much less amount. Is it just, one doctor's billing rate against another? Isn't it the standard of the community and the industry?
It is.
And isn't that how insurance companies figure the rate of their payments to the providers?
Well, frankly, Your Honor, I don't know how the insurance companies figure their rates to their providers, but if Robinson v. Bates continues in the face of this statute, we're going to have insurance executives testifying at these trials as to the reasonableness of these bills. But what's interesting in this case, Judge, is that $21,000 or so was the total amount of charges. Now, there was no introduction of any collateral source benefits here, and yet the jury took it upon themselves to reduce that $21,000 to $15,500. That, in their opinion, was what the reasonable value of those services provided was. Notwithstanding
was
the fact that
there was no evidence submitted one way or the other?
That's correct. There was no evidence submitted that the total amount of the bills was not unreasonable, but the jury took it upon themselves to reduce that amount.
That was still $7,000 more than was actually paid. Right?
Actually, Your Honor, the amount is closer to $7,500, but that amount does not include the deductibles my client paid and his co-payments.
Which were
so
how much?
It's not the total amount.
Which were how much?
I think right around $8,500, $9,000 total.
Copay was $9,000?
No, on top of the $7,500, Your Honor, for a total of $9,000 or so.
Has anyone ever tried to get a legislative rule passed that you put the full amount pay or full amount billed, and the judge does the set-offs as to what you actually end up getting paid? I mean, it would keep everything away from a jury.
There's no legislature in Ohio. Other states do that. In fact, the states that this court relied upon in Robinson versus Bates have that deduction post-verdict. They don't, however, admit this, the collateral source information to the jury, because it doesn't really reflect the reasonableness of the services provided. It reflects a health insurance company's contractual negotiations with a medical care provider.
So in your view, would that be a better way to go about this than to have the jury determine based on the two numbers what the reasonable value is? Have the judge do it afterwards?
I think it would be a fair way. Now, whether the legislature would be up for that, I think is a question for another day, but I think it's fairer than...
Well, we invited them to in Robinson, and they haven't done it yet.
Well, I think, you're right. They didn't change 23-15-20 post-Robinson. However, 23-15-20 is a compromise between the common law collateral source rule and the notion that the amounts charged are somewhat inflated based upon contractual reductions.
Counsel, I'm wondering if the appellant's approach is favored here. Why wouldn't plaintiffs in the future just say to a jury, the medical bills were $21,000 and all but $2,000 have been taken care of, so my client is entitled to $2,000, the rest of it you don't have to concern yourself with, and we're not asking for it. Now, I assume what would happen there, then you force the medical insurer to come in and be a party in the case. Right?
Well, that's true, Your Honor. I mean, you would have to. You make a good point, but the point that appellant has made that we haven't touched upon is the fact that when these amounts are introduced, the health insurance carrier no longer has that right of subrogation whatsoever. The legislature, it seems to me, wanted to protect the rights of the health insurance carriers to make sure they get repaid, so the jury doesn't say, well, we know that this has been paid by health insurance, so we're not going to make an award to the plaintiff for their medical expenses involved. It seems to me that's what the The legislative history of the statute, and in fact, subsection C of the statute clearly says that when those collateral sources are introduced,
why couldn't there be an instruction that this is the amount that the medical insurance company, the insurance company has paid, and therefore is the damage on medical bills? Now you just have to connect it with the injury and the proximate cause.
Well, when there's a right of subrogation, Your Honor, that would be contrary to the statute, but it would also extinguish the subrogation right of the health insurance carrier.
Under the statute, but if we had a different statute that just simply let that be admissible flat out, and the jury is supposed to award something that goes back to the insurance company because the defendant caused the damage. Doesn't matter who paid it, the defendant caused it, and they're liable for it.
Your Honor, if that's something the legislature would
some
want
time,
to take.
I think if, but you can answer the question if you want, but I think you want to make it brief because time is running.
Yep, I'll let Mr. Flowers take over. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. Mr. Flowers.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Mr. Flowers, before you get started here, you knew that was coming.
I'll come back to that one.
Is there a correlation in plaintiff's counsel's strategy between the amount of medical bills, the dollar amount, and the non-economic damages? Is there some that the theory is that if I can really show high medical bills, then that's going to be persuasive with the jury that I've got some serious non-economic damages and I'm going to get a higher award in the arena because I've got higher medical bills, and if I'm forced to let the jury know that, yeah, they were charged $21,000, but really the provider was only paid $10,000, that the jury's going to poo-poo the non-economics. Is that what we're really arguing about here?
Well, I think if I gave you a flat no, I'd be dishonest. Yes, the amount of the medicals drives the case, the non-economics, but I think the way to look at it is when a jury sees that the medical bills sees what they truly are and what it cost, that confirms to them that this is a significant injury, particularly when you have something you can't see, a herniated disc or something like that. So yes, these figures are important to the ultimate award of full compensation. I'll grant you that. But I've listened to this argument, I just felt we're getting so far afield of what the new statute says, and I think that does answer your question, Justice Lundberg-Stratton. If we start talking about, well, we'll let them know this, we'll let them know that, we're violating the statute because the new statute says quite clearly that the amounts payable are not coming in when we have a right of subrogation. So we can't give them the amounts payable. And if you can't give them the amounts payable, you can't tell them what the write-off is. And really, the beauty of following the statute here is that we avoid all the problems we're now seeing in the trial court. I mean, counsel brought up how much discovery they're doing. Well, if you follow the Sixth District, we're not going to be doing that discovery. We're not going to be debating about what was actually paid. We're not going to be throwing this onto jurors. We're not going to be disclosing to them that there's health insurance.
You view that the statute is modified, Robinson.
Correct. What I like, though, is from Robinson, it's paragraph 19 that the Justice Lansinger pointed out. Paragraph 19 of Robinson says, in the end, hey, you know, we're just doing what the General Assembly says we should do. We're going to leave that to them. And that's all we're saying here. We're actually asking you to follow Robinson because it's following the will of the legislature. This is what they laid out. It avoids the whole mess we're seeing now. And most importantly, it avoids not the double recovery, but the double deduction.
Mr. Bell suggested that Robinson is causing havoc across Ohio. What is happening that is so disruptive? Is some following the statute, some following the case, or what is it about Robinson that you find to be so disruptive?
Well, he's talking about when you follow just the Robinson rule and you don't have the statute, and he's absolutely right. I mean, I'm just taking this from my personal experience, the lawyers I've talked to and judges I've talked to, and they're all indicating that this is a mess because you get in insurance one way or the other. It comes in. You find out the plaintiff has insurance, and the problem is the juries are saying, well, all right, if he's got insurance, we're not giving him all those bills. They might not award any medical bills. And then you get subrogation coming in, claiming a part of the recovery. So the plaintiff is getting stuck with a double deduction. They lose it because the jury knows about insurance, and they lose it again when subrogation comes in. That's the real problem here. And you get, as Mr. Dills talked about, we have these discovery disputes going on where give me your collateral source information, I don't want to, it's privileged, blah, 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 we get through all that. If you follow the 6th District, and the 6th District just simply filed the statute, that's all gone. We're back to a very simple procedure now where we avoid double recoveries and we avoid double deductions.
How does it work evidentiary under the new statute, and does Robinson apply to non-subrogated amounts?
Well, under the new statute, any amounts payable do not come in if there's a right of subrogation.
Right, but let's say you have an insurance company that pays a bill, it's $10,000, the insurance company pays $5,000, but they have no right of subrogation. How does that, what do you present to a jury?
Well, if there's no right of subrogation, then he's right. You're gonna get in both the amount, the full amount, and the amount that's payable, because the statute says that.
And that's sort of the Robinson theory that,
right.
But that, under the statute, only applies to the non-subrogated part.
Right, and let me point out, I mean, I've got a smile on my face, because that's a rare situation, and it's a boon for the plaintiff to begin with, because there's no right of subrogation. So they're coming out ahead. I don't think many plaintiffs are going to complain too much when they know there's no subrogation about the lower amount coming in, because they're not going to have to pay that back. So it's a rare situation, and I'll grant him that that will happen in a small number of cases. But in the overwhelming majority of the ones, there's subrogation, we get into insurance, we cause all sorts of problems with the juries, and that's why going strictly with the statute is not only the legal approach, it's the best approach. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flowers. Mr. Dills, in addition to your almost 7 minutes of time, I'll give you 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would only wish to clarify that the havoc that we're experiencing is that some courts are following Robinson and ignoring 2315 and permitting the evidence to be submitted to the jury. And so the juries in some cases, even within the same courthouse, are seeing different evidences based upon a different rule. That's not happening any longer in our district in Toledo, where this whole thing started. But it's now being seen across the state where some are following what the 6th District has said, some are following the new statute 2315, and some are following Robinson. And so if you look in any across the state, and we've alluded to it in our briefs, and particularly our jurisdictional brief in this case, that it's all over the board, all over the state.
At the very least, we have to clarify footnote one and say whether Robinson stands alone, if it works in tandem with the statute, if it has been limited by the statute. I mean, that's the very least that we have to do. Would you agree?
Yes, Your Honor. That's okay. What we're asking. And just as a final aside,
very quickly,
in the 37 plus years that I've been trying personal injury litigation as a defense lawyer, it's been my experience that the minute that we send that jury into deliberations, the first question is asked is when do we go to lunch? And the second question that comes out in written form is how much of the medical bills did the insurance companies pay? And of course, we send them back the information that you're not to consider that evidence, but nonetheless, it's on their minds all the time.
Thank you, Mr. Dills.
Thank you, Justice.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.